Okay, so my next guest has been named one of the 50 best comedians of the 21st century. Not once, but twice. I'm sitting down with none other than British stand-up comedian Nish Kumar, whose politically charged jokes are just as sharp as his political commentary. And when he's not touring, he's also the co-host of a successful podcast here in the UK called Pod Save the UK. So in light of Zahran Mamdani's win in New York, we're gonna be sitting down at a cafe to talk about what his win means to Nish, also progressive politics in the UK, the far right, Nish's own personal experiences, and hopefully some laughs along the way. The common denominator that you speak about in a lot of these publications is Nando's.
The spice factor means that it brings in quite a diverse range of communities.
It's what's uniting the country.
Yeah, it's the only thing keeping this country together.
My name is Mohammed Hashim.
My name is Nish Kumar.
And this is...
Real Talk.
Nish Kumar, thank you so much for coming on Real Talk.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
No, it's such a pleasure. You know, as I was reading, the first thing that came to mind... You wanted to be on Hot Ones. You know, you said that that was a dream of yours. And at one point I was like, you know, I really want to make this happen. But it's early in the morning.
Yeah.
I was like, should I just bring a bunch of wings and then just start it from there? Maybe slide the interview.
I really, really love hot wings. And so the idea that you could do a chat show where somebody was preparing you hot wings was so appealing to me.
Yeah.
Like a few years ago, I did... a sketch for a platform that no longer exists. So there's no point in Googling it because you can't find this anywhere. But we played a game of historical hot ones,
yep.
Where we ate wings commensurate to the historical spiciness of statues from across the United Kingdom. And it meant that I tried the bomb.
The bomb, you actually tried it, the sauce. Right.
It's one of those things where you're like, it's not even pleasurable.
I haven't gone that far yet.
And the thing is, it keeps on kind of, it keeps on recurring. Like, I've never taken LSD, but it feels like the closest I'll ever get to taking LSD. It was like, I was like Homer Simpson in that episode where, like, I was hallucinating a coyote voice by Johnny Cash. Like, it was that level of, like, it was so hot that I saw through time and space.
You would be great on that show, though. Like, I could picture, you know, like, you know when the Next Up thing loops on YouTube and you have Kevin Hart or Jennifer Lawrence or something, and then Next Up, it's Nish Kumar.
Sub guy.
You know, on this topic, before we get to Mamdani and I ask you about it, there is something I need to understand, Nish, because as I was reading up on you just about your upbringing and stuff and looking up previous interviews, the one thing, the common denominator that you speak about in a lot of these publications is Nando's. And you need to, okay, I really need to understand. I'm not from the UK, if you haven't noticed by now. But
the accent was a bit of a giveaway. It was a little bit of a giveaway.
I need to understand, what is this whole thing with British people and peri-peri chicken from Nando's? I don't get the Nando's obsession. And I feel like you'd be the guy to break it down.
And listen, I've done a decent amount of traveling in the world, and people will often say, why are you all so obsessed with Nando's? I think I'm obsessed with Nando's. Like, I remember my first Nando's. Like, I truly...
It's, wow.
I really, it's like, it's a seminal moment for me. I was in a shopping centre in Finchley, and we saw this, like, and it said, like, hot chicken. And I was with my family, who are famously brown. And... my dad can't eat anything. Like, my dad can eat, my dad likes going to really nice restaurants, but like your standard readily available British food or fast food will, and I'm quoting directly here, block me up for the month. So he just can't countenance it. But we went to Nando's and my entire family loved it because it was spicy. Like the hot sauce at Nando's is actually legit spicy.
Yeah.
And so it was, this like great thing where
medium,
like,
is playing it safe.
Medium is totally edible. I've been with a friend of mine who actually ordered plain. He'd no sauce.
I've never tried that, so I wouldn't know what it's
the
like.
Guy's Irish, okay. I think he was like, I don't even want to play with the most moderate amount of spice. I don't even want
to. It's just Georgie here is Irish. That's hilarious. I love it.
He was
it.
Just like, I don't even want to play with it. It's David O'Doherty, I'll out him. He's a comedian. He was literally like, I don't even want to play with the lemon and herb. I think that might be too much for me. But I think it's that. I think that the spice factor means that it brings in quite a diverse range of communities. Like, that if makes you go sense. To Nando's,
that makes sense.
It really, that's real Britain. That's what Britain looks like. Every race is represented.
It's what's uniting the country.
Yeah, it's the only thing keeping this country together. And also, I think there was a real dearth of, like, British food has a bad reputation internationally, and it's always been a little unfair because Britain is kind of a great place to eat if you have a lot of money. There's always been really fancy restaurants, but also if you seek out food that's been made by the various immigrant communities that come to this country. You know, like, for a long time, when my dad would go to the States or Canada, he would be like, the standard of Indian food is nowhere near. I think it's changed now because the demographics have shifted and there's more South Asian immigration to those countries. But in the, like, 80s, he was like, it's really hard to get good Indian food. Whereas here, we've always had really good Indian food. But I would say, like, the standard, bog standard, you just walk in off the street to a random place, the food standard has always been rubbish.
Yeah.
And I remember going to Australia for the first time with a friend of mine, and he had this terrible moment of realization, probably about 12 years ago. And he had this terrible moment of realization. He just said to me, like, is our food shit? Because everywhere we go into, the food is decent. And I don't think that's true. And I was like, yeah, it is famously. So when Nando's opened, I think it was like, you know, it's going to be good. And also, I think Nando's is unfairly, it's sort of overrepresented in culture, because if you're a touring performer or, like, you have any reason to, or if you have, like, a job in the media, which means that you're, like, going from London to Manchester to Edinburgh to Glasgow, like, there's something reliable about Nando's. So I think it's culturally overrepresented.
The thing is, you know, it's because when I go back home or when I travel, people are always like, oh, you're like, you know, are you eating a lot of fish and chips, or are you eating a lot of Sunday roast and stuff? And I'm like, no, man, I've just been eating a lot of peri-peri chicken.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the popular thing in the UK. That's what people in the UK do. Yeah, they go to Nando's. But yeah, no. Good breakdown.
I genuinely think it's just particularly, like, if I think back to, like, the 90s, there was a lot of wimpy. You would have no clue of what wimpy was.
I know because of my dad.
Really?
Yes, because we're Egyptian, and my dad grew up in Egypt, and I think that was, like, one of the first burger joints to open in Egypt.
Wimpy!
Like, way back
wimpy
then.
Wimpy made it to Egypt!
Like, 70s. 70s. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Listen, I don't mean to malign the good people at Wimpy, but a lot of that meat was grey. I don't know what animal some of that meat came from. I don't know an animal that colour or that uniform texture of flesh. It doesn't even make biological or physiological sense that it would just be the same all the way down. That's weird. But there was a lot of just, like, that bog standard, you go in off the street, it was rubbish. I mean, I've got a lot of love in my heart for proper British greasy spoons. I maintain no country does greasy spoons like we do.
See, we should have had food.
Yeah, we should have eaten.
We should have had food.
It's different now, I would say. Like, now, I think the expectation of the British public for what the standard of food has got much higher. Yeah. So it's definitely changed. And the Australians came here in great numbers and bought their brunch culture. So now people are like, maybe you could have vegetables at breakfast. This is a huge innovation. This is a tectonic shift in our understanding of what breakfast can be. Previously, breakfast was just porridge or
beans.
Most of a pig.
Well, I hope you're enjoying the coffee.
Yeah, it's fantastic. It's absolutely fantastic.
Look, we're filming this about 2 days after Zohran Mamdani won.
Mm.
I'm just saying this for people watching, because by the time it goes out, it'll be later. Your reaction to the Democratic Socialist Muslim mayor-elect of New York?
I think maybe, like, I'm 4 years old, and I think maybe I'm hoping that I'm the last generation of people of color where their first reaction to something good happening to another person of color isn't, oh my god, I'm so worried about it.
Yeah. No, like, that's a fair point.
Like, my
that is a very fair point.
If I'm being honest with you, like, my first thought in all those situations is, I hope he is safe. I hope he, and I'm sure, and I know he is going to be ready for, we're about to enter into a sort of, like, vintage era of racism, because I mean, we've sort of seen it, having a Muslim South Asian mayor in London.
Yeah,
you know, you see the kind of bile that's poured out, and you know, I think that that is going to be complicated and tricky for him. I mean, obviously, he ran an incredible campaign. You know, he ran an incredible campaign. His communications were incredible. His like relentless focus on policy and his constant stressing on affordability and how New York needs to change to make it more habitable for New Yorkers is what has cut through here.
And he didn't just beat Cuomo. Like, he beat Cuomo, he beat the billionaires behind Cuomo, the Bill Ackmans, the Rupert Murdochs.
He also beat, I'm sorry to say, he also beat a core of the Democratic establishment as well. He's slightly left egg on the face of a few very high-profile Democrats, you know, Chuck Schumer, Hakeem Jeffries, who sort of either didn't endorse or dragged their feet on endorsements for the person who was the Democratic candidate, you know, who won the primary. The machinery of the party seemed so reluctant to throw its weight behind him. And now it leaves them, you know, kind of embarrassed a little bit. But yeah, incredible campaign. He's a phenomenal communicator.
What do you think the reaction in the UK is? Like, from at least the few conversations I've been having the last couple of days, maybe, like, what is the sentiment in this
There's
country?
An interesting reaction here, because the immediate pivot is to, why can't we have our own Mamdani, or who is our Mamdani? And I think some of that is interesting. Some of that is, sometimes in comparisons between the US and the UK are really interesting and really can inform how we should be doing politics in this country. And there are other times where you think, I don't know how useful that conversation is sometimes. Like, I don't know how useful it is for us to be talking about, do we need our own Mamdani? Because I feel like that...
Well, that's happening with Polanski, isn't it? They're labeling him as the UK Mamdani.
They definitely are, right? And, you know...
But I like what you're saying in terms of, like, I don't know if this is useful for the UK.
Yeah.
Like, what do you mean by that?
I think that there are sort of political and like cultural differences within our politics that mean that it's not easy to make a straight transition from we just need a UK version. You know, it's not The Office. You know, you can't just sort of remake it from one country to another. Like, there are, I mean,
wait, so Ricky Gervais doesn't show up?
Yeah. And even if you are, you have to be aware of the kind of the big things I think that we can learn from Mamdani particularly are, I think it's time to trust a different generation of political leaders. I think that, you know, I'm not ageist and I'm not in favor of sweeping away generations just because they hit a certain age. But I definitely think it's time that people in their 30s, it's time that people my age were brought into more and more leadership positions in political parties, because, you know, millennials are no longer young people. I'm 40 years old.
Right.
We are the age of prime ministers and presidents now. And I think it's important to see more voices from those generations be elevated into leadership positions. Not because I think we're particularly a great generation. I actually don't. I'm slightly worried about people like me being in leadership positions, like a whole generation that's defined ourselves through Simpsons memes. I'm not sure that we're... I'm worried about us as political leaders, but we also have a very specific set of life experiences. We've interacted with economic and market forces in a way that gives us a slightly different perspective on them to different generations. And, you know, we're no longer children. We are of age, you know. So I
that
think
hits that hard. That hits hard, Nish.
Well, how old are you?
I'm 30. What am I? I'm 33.
You're Mamdani's age, right? Is he 34?
He's a year older.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So, like, you know, we're not children. So
we're not children.
But I also think there's a policy there was a relentless policy focus that I think actually a lot of progressive politicians could learn from. And I think also there's this understanding that you have to actually offer people something to vote for rather than scaring them into voting against something.
But before I unpack this even more, because I do want to get into the UK politics of things, just one quick thing about how you said that you're worried about Mamdani. What worries you the most?
I'm worried for him.
Yeah.
I'm not worried about him.
Yeah,
I'm
worried
for him, you know, because there is going to be this unholy unleashing of racist forces against him.
And it's already happened in the campaign.
Yeah, it's been happening all through the campaign. You know, Cuomo sort of laughing along to 9/11 jokes.
Yep.
The just casualized Islamophobia. I mean, we see huge amounts of racist invective directed from America at Sadiq Khan.
Yeah.
You know, who's the mayor of London. And we've seen how
who's not getting a lot of racism here.
Yeah. You see a huge amount of, like, internal racism from the UK. And then you also see quite a lot of, you know, racism coming at him from America as well. And so I'm concerned for him from that perspective. I'm always concerned about politicians of colour just from a race perspective. I'm also concerned about the kind of forces that it unleashes. I mean, there's a lot of complicated conversations to talk about in the rise of Donald Trump, but it is important to always acknowledge that he came to prominence as a political figure, not as a cultural figure or an entertainment figure. He came to prominence as a political figure, as the most public mouthpiece of the birther movement, which is an explicitly racist conspiracy theory that Barack Obama was not born in America. That is the entry point for Donald Trump into the political conversation. The election of Obama as America's first black president also coincides, and it is the kind of catalyst for
the
movement
party
within the Republican Party called the Tea Party. Yep. Why did they pick the name Tea Party? They picked it because it's an explicit point of American history before the abolition of slavery. They didn't call it the Lincoln Movement. They didn't call it the Abraham Lincoln. That would have been a much more logical name for a movement trying to celebrate a Republican president. They called it the Tea Party because it was a specific point in American history and an event that happened before the abolition of slavery. So you see these kind of racist forces be unleashed. But I think that's not a reason to not have people of color run. And that's not a reason to, it's just, I'm old, I'm afraid. But I think he is, you know, he's charismatic. He looks good on camera. That I think helps. But also, he is funny and
speaking
engaging.
Arabic
he's
in
speaking
videos.
Arabic, speaking Hindi. He's sort of, but also relentless policy focus. He focused on affordability. Yeah. He didn't get sidetracked into culture war conversations. He was kind of unapologetic about it. He said, you know, I have a certain set of beliefs. I will always stand up for marginalized communities in New York, the LGBTQIA community. He was unequivocal in his comments about the genocide in Palestine. He didn't compromise on those beliefs. I think that's a really important lesson for progressives to learn, that you can, I think sometimes we talk about things as if they're a zero-sum game, and that talking about issues around marginalized communities detracts from a focus on class-based politics. And actually, one of the really important things that Mamdani has shown is you can play both of those things. You can do both of those things. You can be unapologetic in fighting for affordability for people and fighting to improve the lives of working class people in your country. And you can also be unapologetic in your focus on equality for ethnic minorities, the LGBTQIA community, women's rights. Like, we really are at a point in this progressive cycle, because we've taken so many beatings over the last however many years, that we've come to this place where we now think that we have to compromise on our commitment to equality. But Mamdani, I think what I hope we learn from his victory is that you don't have to do that. Also, progressive political parties need to learn that you have to offer, you have to make an offering to people. You have to say, this is what we're voting for. Yeah. Not that, no, this guy is scary. Don't vote for this. If you don't vote for me, the scary guy gets it.
Yeah. No, but this is actually what I would ask you in terms of, if we bring it across the pond here to the UK, progressive politics here, there's a lot happening on that side. We talked about Polanski. Mm. We talked about, you know, how he's being labeled the UK Mamdani, and you don't see it as beneficial to the campaign, perhaps.
I'm not sure how beneficial that is as a comparison. Like, he's...
But even beyond that,
yeah.
Even beyond that, Nish, I think there's not really a broad coalition of progressive politics here, is there? Because we're already seeing a lot of cracks happening. We see Polanski and how he's galvanized the youth, right? And how he's become quite popular over the last month or so.
Tremendous communicator.
Couple months.
And I've been really impressed watching. You know, I've interviewed him a couple of times.
Yeah.
And I've been really, really impressed with him. And he has a really fluent command of political rhetoric, and he also has a kind of, he has a policy platform he's pushing, and you can see a kind of coherent vision starting to emerge for what a Green Party manifesto will look like at the next election, which I think is really, really important. You know, it's not just, he's not just good at the kind of soundbite internet politics. Yeah. I think he's actually starting to grow a properly cohesive policy platform.
Yeah, and he's recognizable to young voters as well.
Totally.
Yeah, which is a new thing.
Yeah.
But the reason why I said cracks is because I was gonna start asking you about your party, the Zarya Sultana Jeremy Corbyn party. But even before that, do you think the Greens under Polanski, are they a threat to Labour or a threat to reform? Or, sorry, a threat to Labour or more helping reform get more seats?
Well, this is obviously the conversation we're all having, right?
Yeah.
As I've used we slightly, you know, maybe slightly lazily. I mean, the progressive people in this country, every conversation I have with all my friends is this going to split the vote and lead to a reform majority at the next election? And I've been able to ask Zarya Sultana and Zach Polanski that to
whether they would join.
The thing that everyone is saying right now is don't focus too much on that because the election's quite far away. Your party needs to work out what its power structure is, how it's going to organise itself, what its policy platform is going to be. There's a long way to go. The Greens, you know, Polanski's only been leader. He was made leader a couple of months ago, so he's got a long way to go. There's a lot of road to travel before we get to an election. They've all sort of been quite keen to stress that they would work to avoid a reform-led government. And that makes me hopeful that there would actually be cooperation between progressive political parties, because...
But what do you make of the schism inside your party? Like everything we've been seeing kind of unfold.
I actually don't know what's going on internally within your party. I think there seems to be a lot of public infighting. There's a suggestion of private infighting. I don't know how that shakes down. I've been very impressed with Zarya Sultana on the occasions that I've met and interviewed her.
Yeah.
And
she told you that, I think in one of the interviews, she said that she doesn't believe that there's room for people who have socially conservative views, right? I
think she did. She was very kind of, she was unequivocal in her commitment to women's rights and trans rights, and that there wouldn't be any space for people to, there wouldn't be any room for equivocation on those kind of things, which I think is something that I think, again, the Mamdani campaign shows you. You know, you can build a broad coalition of voters without compromising on your commitment to equality and human rights. And
so would that be like a criticism of yours of the left here or of progressives here, maybe?
I think sometimes here, I think the truth is here, the progressive movement doesn't really know. The progressive movement is somewhat rudderless in this country and has been for the last few years, only because, you know, Corbyn's Labour took such a beating in 2019. There was a kind of schism within the progressive political movement about how to respond to Brexit. You know, Brexit kind of drove a wedge between within the two main political parties in this country. And there was a schism on how the Labour Party should respond to that going into the 2019 election. There is this sense that it is impossible to win an election on a progressive political platform. It's impossible to win a general election on a progressive political platform, and there's a kind of hopelessness that's set in this country in the last few years. I think particularly because the Labour Party that has won this resounding majority did so almost on a kind of platform of continuity.
Yeah.
Particularly in economic terms. Now we're talking a couple of weeks before the budget. We don't know what that budget is going to reveal and what it involves, but there has been a sense of... I interviewed the Tom McTague from The New Statesman, who wrote a long piece about Keir Starmer, and he said something that I thought was fascinating. He said that Starmer doesn't necessarily believe there's anything wrong with the UK institutions. He just thinks that they've been managed poorly. And that, I think, is a concerning analysis of what's gone wrong in this country in the last 15 years. We need massive investment in our infrastructure, and we need massive investment in our healthcare and education sectors. These are not institutions that are working properly, but are just being mismanaged. There is an actual problem of funding in all of these areas. You know, if you talk to teachers, you talk to doctors, if you try and get a train from Liverpool to Manchester, you can see that there are real serious problems in the infrastructure of this country. We've got a kind of crisis of underinvestment, and our economy has been so mismanaged. I think particularly in the aftermath of the 2008 financial crisis, I think the kind of legacy of austerity politics is that, you know, we always talk about difficult choices that need to be made, but whenever we talk about difficult choices, it's only framed from the prism of how much spending you're going to cut. We never talk about difficult choices from the perspective of we may have to tax wealthier people in this country a bit more. Now, again, we're talking before the budget, it may be that Rachel Reeves does change the taxation system, but part of the problem is all through the 2010s, the only difficult choices that were made by the government in this country was how much are you going to cut in terms of government spending. And that's left us in a situation where the institutions and the infrastructure of this country is crumbling around us. And we are being encouraged to focus our anger on the crumbling infrastructure, on immigrants and refugees, and asylum seekers. We've had such a disingenuous conversation about what is going wrong in this country. And it's been happening for just years and years and years. And the thing that concerns me, and I think the reason that a lot of progressives are feeling deflated, is that it seems like the only way the Labour Party can win an election is if it promises continuity austerity, and if it promises a package of fiscal conservatism, and it makes minor policy changes and does some good things, but does them almost quietly and is almost kind of trying to sneak economic rebalancing in. But there is a real appetite, and there is also just a need in this country for massive investment. Like we need to change the way our economy is operating, because it is not delivering for the majority of people in the United Kingdom.
Yeah. And the media plays a role too, Nish. I feel like when you mention about, you know, people perceiving that the issues that this country faces is more related to migration and immigrants and all of that, it's related to the media's role, right? Because they definitely platform reform and people from the far right a lot more than they would people from like the Greens. And I think the public just gets hammered by these talking points that it's actually migration and immigrants that are the real issues facing this country.
The number one problem that we face as a country in our politics is the focus on immigration. That is the biggest
problem.
Yeah. The amount of conversation and energy we expend talking about immigration. And the second problem within that is the total lack of facts or figures or statistics in that conversation. So we're having a sort of factless conversation every single day about immigration. And, you know, we sort of loosely conflate immigration and refugees and asylum seekers. These are all quite different things that are going on right at the same time. And we conflate all of them.
Yeah.
It's a conversation not rooted in facts or statistics. It's a conversation rooted in pure prejudice, and it serves the ruling class to keep powerless people at each other's throats. It serves the, you know, wannabe oligarchs of this country to have white working class people focusing all of their anger and disgust at immigrant communities and refugees and asylum seekers.
Do you think the political class is racist? Is that a tough broad question to ask?
No, I mean, listen, we have a huge problem with institutional racism in this country. Of course we do. I think you can acknowledge that things have definitely improved. I would say we're in a backslide right now. Like, I don't think it's linear. It's not been a constant, steady line of improvement. But if you look at conditions for ethnic minorities in this country right now, it's definitely better than it was in the 1970s when my mum first came here. Or it certainly was better than it was in the 1970s when my mum first came here. Now I think we're in a moment of decline in terms of our rights. But we talk about we always talk about institutional racism and then forget it the second we have a conversation about things that are going on now. Like, we're very comfortable with talking about institutional racism theoretically, but then when it actually comes to saying things like, are British institutions racist, we then tend to like equivocate around it. Let's be real here. We decided racism was bad societally in like the 1960s. And even then, it didn't really take hold. You know, you're talking about hundreds of years of ingrained prejudice, prejudice that is ingrained into the institutions of this country. You know, that's why, you know, when you're trying to, that's why it's important, the conversation that we were trying to have that's now been interrupted about things like slavery and colonialism. One of the reasons people were trying to have those conversations is to explain that the reason that these institutions are racist is because the roots of it run deep. The roots of, you know, where the money comes from in this country is so intrinsically linked to the exploitation of black and brown people that, of course, we're still seeing the vestiges of it in our day-to-day life. And I think there are obviously still elements of the British state that are racist. But what concerns me almost as much is the number of the elements of the British political class that is comfortable with racism. That's the thing.
How normalized it's become.
But is also unwilling to, or drags its feet when it comes to standing unapologetically against racism. That's almost the thing that concerns me as much as the institutional racism that's still prevalent. I mean, we definitely got a race problem. We got a race problem in this country, and you try and have that conversation and you're perennially accused of importing American talking points. But like, came of age in this country in the time of Stephen Lawrence. I came of age in this country at a time where John Charles de Menezes, a Brazilian man, was shot by the Metropolitan Police based on what we then found out to be no evidence of terrorist activity. You know,
but you're touching on a very important point right now, because I think this is a prevalent talking point here in the UK, especially when you start talking politics, you start talking US politics. And the reaction that you get from a lot of the people is like, you know, and it could be, there's some guests I had on the show that said this, but it could also just be everyday conversations where it's like, oh, thank God we're not the US.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, thank God this is happening over there. Thank God that we're, you know, we're different.
Yeah.
But is it? I don't know.
I always stress to people, Renier de Lodge's book, Why I'm No Longer Talking to White People About Race, a big part of why that book was such a phenomenal bestseller is because it engaged in a distinctly British conversation about race and racism. And she's an incredible writer, and she was very disciplined in her focus. And she tried to start a distinctly British conversation about the British history of racism. And it's a conversation that we definitely should have. You know, in 2016, a white sitting MP was assassinated by a man who in court gave his name as Freedom for Britain. The white MP in question, Joe Cox, was an advocate of rights for refugees and immigrants. You know, that's an act of far-right terrorism. David Amos, an MP, was also murdered by Islamists. Two brutal murders of MPs. But we rightly have no problem in discussing Islamist terrorism, and we have absolutely rightly no problem in saying that that is not an ideology that we want to have kind of pounding in the veins of our society. But an act of far-right terrorism was so roundly dismissed by large sections of the British press, and it was dismissed as he was just nuts. It meant that we never really stopped to actually have a conversation about Joe Cox's death. Like, we never really stopped to have that conversation.
Yeah. And September, you know, the biggest far-right rally in Britain's history, was over 100,000 people or something.
Yeah, I mean, that is incredibly alarming. That is incredibly alarming. And it's alarming for two reasons. It's alarming just from, like, a lot of us, you know, British people who feel unsafe walking in our streets. You know, that is really, really concerning. You know,
Do you feel unsafe?
Yeah, man. Of course I feel unsafe. I'm getting, everybody's texting everybody. The WhatsApp groups are full of people going, are you safe? Are you okay? If you're traveling on your own, can you text me when you get in? That's happening all the time. That's happening constantly. My mum is like having a kind of reaction like it's the 70s again. You know, like, so people are feeling unsafe. But also, what I would say to white British people is, we feel unsafe. Also, you are being hoodwinked. You are being distracted by this conversation about immigrants and immigration from the real factors at play in the economic problems in this country. That's the greatest trick of racism, is that it keeps people scared and it keeps the people that aren't scared distracted. That is the most toxic thing about racism. That's why racism is racism is kind of two things. It's a poisonous ideology that radicalizes people, but it's also a kind of useful distraction tool for a ruling class, you know? And when I see Mark Zuckerberg talking about, you know, we're getting rid of DEI, and, you know, I don't think Mark Zuckerberg has any opinions about people of different races. I mean, he is barely the same species as us, let's be honest. Like, Bezos and Zuckerberg at this point, I don't know how much genetic overlap there is between some of these tech CEOs. With all the biohacking shit that they're doing, I don't know that we're, like, dealing with... These are barely the same species. You're telling me you look at Peter Thiel and you think that guy's the same species as us? I don't think he is. I think I have as much genetically in common with this table as I do with Peter Thiel at this point. But, like, so I don't think it's of interest to them, but... When you saw them all line up behind Trump, and when you see them all saying, yep, this is an end to woke, this is an end to DEI, why are they doing that? Is it because they're ideologically, radicalized? Maybe some of them is. Maybe Elon is. Maybe, right? But for most of them, it doesn't really compute. It's a useful way to keep powerless people at each other's throats. It's a useful way to stop us from talking about how much literal capital and political capital is being swallowed up by a kind of oligarchical class. The thing that annoys me most about these tech disruptors is they are not innovators. They might be innovators in terms of the field of technology, but they're not political innovators. They're not innovators of power. They believe that they should be making all the decisions because they believe that the wealthiest people are the wisest people. That's not a new idea. You've invented feudalism. Like, you've just reinvented the way that countries operated in the goddamn Middle Ages. Like, you know, that's all they are. They're just new barons.
You know what, Nish? I see why you draw the ire of the right in this country. At first, I was like, no, it can't be that bad. And then...
The tragedy is, I'm a really nice guy. Outside of this, I'm a lot of fun to be around.
No, you are. You are. But there is something to be said about this, because, I mean, there's a lot of hit pieces on you. There's a lot of, genuinely, yeah, there's a lot of these pieces that are overly critical of you just for, you know, criticizing the government or criticizing, yeah, the political climate and constantly tying it back to the MASH report.
Yeah.
And even till just a few weeks ago, there was an article in the Spectator that I read about you.
Yeah.
But I think there's something to be said here, because I remember you saying something along the lines of, you have felt for a while that because of the color of your skin, that people didn't want you to be criticizing the country.
Or for sure.
You know, people didn't feel comfortable having someone like you, yeah, being critical of the political climate.
Yeah, for sure. I definitely think there was a lot of, how dare you, you're ungrateful. I think in the terms of the way that some of the anger that's aimed towards me, there is a definite element of, how dare you be this ungrateful to this country that has given
you. It's because you're the descendant of immigrants, so you have to be, yeah, grateful for everything that this country has given
100%.
You.
100%. Yeah, 100%. The problem is, you've raised me to think that I was British. Like, that's my anger with the kind of, that's why I'm so angry with the establishment of this country. Is when I was growing up in the 1990s, we were encouraged to think of ourselves as being British. So if I'm British, I have the same rights as anybody else to criticize the government of this country, to criticize elements of the media of this country. Like, you told me I had the same rights as everybody else, but when I used some of those rights, a lot of you shat your pants and got very, very upset. Some of the criticism of me was also, especially between 2017 and 2020, a kind of proxy way of criticising the BBC. It was a kind of useful entry point for a lot of people that, because I was doing a satirical comedy show on the BBC that, you know, aimed its jokes at the government of the day.
Boris Johnson.
Yeah, Boris Johnson, Theresa May, you know, there's that period of time.
Yeah.
That, you know, that aimed its jokes at the government of the day and Brexit, which, you know, was the kind of dominant force in British politics at the time. And
were you prepped for the backlash, though? Because it seemed to be quite heavy.
No, I wasn't. I will say this, and it's always important for me to stress this. My partner, who is white, at the start of the MASH report, maybe like the first or second episode, said, I think you should see a therapist because I don't think this is going to be a normal experience. She said, I think you're about to wind up. We were on a train back from or up to Edinburgh.
What did you say? You're like, nah, I got this under control.
I was like, listen.
What are you talking about?
Therapy is white nonsense.
Shmerapy.
Yeah. I was like, listen, I am a cisgendered heterosexual man, and as such, I've been blessed with an absolute full deck of cards, mental health-wise. No, I thought it was indulgent and... I felt it was ungrateful because of the opportunity I was being given. Like, I was doing my dream job. Like, I was hosting a satirical comedy show on the BBC. That was, like, my dream job. And so, at the time, I thought seeking help or support for that felt indulgent and ungrateful for the opportunity that I was being given.
Really?
Yeah, I really did. Like, I was naive, I think. And also, there was genuinely a bit of me that was like, well, this is fine. I've grown up watching all of these people. But then when I actually think back on it, you know, I grew up watching a lot of people that did take a huge amount of shit. I just didn't recognise it. You know, like, I loved Chris Morris. And Brass Eye caused so much fuss in this country that, like people involved in the show had to go into hiding at one point. So, like, in a way, I wasn't conscious of the lineage that I was trying to insert myself into. But I remember us being on a train and person in front of us was reading a Daily Mail and turned the page, and there was a huge double picture of me. And I remember Amy saying, I don't think this is going to be a normal experience. I think you might need some help managing this. Also, the show was successful. Mm. Not like the first four episodes were pretty successful, but then in January of 2018, the show really became successful, and clips from the show were going viral persistently. And so I was sort of the opinion that, you know, this is great, this is fine. Like, if there's backlash, I don't think I fully understood how big the backlash was going to be. I definitely didn't understand how much kind of hostility it was going to provoke. I mean, there's some stuff that wasn't funny, but there's some stuff that's very funny.
But the thing is, those on the right who have been critical of you, they always tie it back, I feel, to two main factors. It was the fact that they're saying, oh, well, he wasn't funny, this wasn't, you know, this wasn't doing its part or whatever. And then there's a second part where it was like, oh, it's just ratings. It was just unacceptable, you know, why is he talking about this? This had nothing to do with politics. This had nothing to do with the BBC trying to appease those on the right or whatever you believe the reason was. It was more of just the fact that this was an unsuccessful show and it was axed, then he should stop talking about it.
Yeah, it was, which both of those things can't be true. Like, it can't be that it was a malign cultural force that needed to be removed from the television and also no one was watching it. Like, because if no one's watching it, why are you making such a big deal about it? And if it's such a big deal, then you can't then write, but that's a playbook, right? When the show was on the air, there were loads of articles saying, you have to get this off, it's biased, it's imbalancing the BBC, it's biased, it has to be removed from the air. Then the second it went off the air, it said, well, it was just ratings, it had nothing to do with it. And this exact same thing happened with Jimmy Kimmel.
Yeah.
There was this whole thing saying what he said is the most offensive possible thing. So then the chairman of the FCC, who's appointed by the president of America, goes on a podcast and says, you know, if they're going to keep Jimmy Kimmel on air, we need to start looking at licenses. So then Disney pulls Kimmel off the air. And then as soon as that happens, J.D. Vance comes out and says, this has nothing to do with politics. It was to do with ratings. It was to do with declining ratings. And
this is where you see it as a playbook.
Yeah, and I kind of had like a couple of quite fraught conversations with news producers in Britain that week, because they were asking me to come on and talk about it. And I was sort of saying, like, this is kind of what happened to me, guys. So, and, you know, I had people say, no, no, this is completely different. And I was like, no, this is exactly how it's going to shake down. They're going to say that it was because of Charlie Kirk until the point at which he's removed from air. And then the second that happens, they're going to say it had nothing to do with that. It was all about ratings. Trump said that it was all about ratings the second
he
came off air.
He did, yeah.
And all these credulous morons that were trying to talk to me about it in the British media were basically saying, no, no, it's different because this is a specific thing that's happened. And I was like, no, it's the fucking same. Watch what happens. And then it all happened. And once again, I was right. I've been right maybe 5 times in my life. So I know.
This was one of them.
Yeah, this was one of them. I know it because it's a weird, unfamiliar feeling. I'm so frequently wrong that occasionally I feel something, I go, this feels different. And you go, it's because you're right. Like a stopped clock.
Listen, I knew this was going to be like this. But did the BBC ever clarify their position?
No. Not to my knowledge.
Nothing. No backdoor conversations that you were having at the time when they decided.
No, I got an email from somebody saying.
I guess I'm trying to dig into what gave you that inkling that it was about politics and not about anything else.
Well, to be honest with you, I didn't have that inkling until The Sun ran a piece in the paper saying that the Director General of the BBC had removed the show because of a war on wokeness. That's right. The inkling. And then I said to them, somebody needs to clarify this that this publicly isn't the case. And nobody has. And I've talked about it hundreds of times now in various different interviews. And nobody has ever said anything. And so I don't really know what's going on, like, if I'm honest. It's a weird thing. But I'm proud of the show. And like, I'm proud of the work that we did. I'm especially proud of the last series we did for the BBC because it was made in lockdown, in kind of the very early COVID lockdown. And, you know, everybody was like working really hard from their houses. And it, you know, and like, it, part of the reason we were able to get cameras out to everybody is because our producers at the time did not trust Boris Johnson to handle the pandemic properly. So when he started saying there won't be a lockdown, they were like, we need to prepare for a lockdown because this man does not know what's going on. And so that kind of the institutional mistrust of the producers of that show that had been bred really by doing a job where you were reading the things Boris Johnson was saying and doing on a kind of week to week basis for your job actually helped prepare us for doing the show in lockdown.
You know, I'm gonna read your quote because I did a lot of research, right? I do my research on the show, and there's one quote that I want to read up to you, which grabbed my attention.
Yeah.
As a teenager, I was a real piece of shit. Now, Nish, you know, on this show we try to really understand the person.
Yeah.
What'd you mean by that?
What I meant by that was this. I often, the comedian James Acaster says that I always should tell people that when I was a teenager and at university, I was in the debating society. And he says you should always tell people that because he explains a lot about your personality and comedy. One of the most damning things anyone's ever said to me, but it is accurate. I was just very loud and very confident in asserting my opinions, which is not charming. It's certainly not charming when it's a 16-year-old wearing a tea-stained Beatles tie. It's not like, I just felt that my opinion had value, and which is fine and probably good.
But don't you need to have that as a comedian, as a stand-up comedian?
Yeah, I think so. But I think you also, the good thing about stand-up comedy is that it is, well, it's a mixed bag. Stand-up comedy is the most humbling and least humbling job you can possibly do. there's a kind of great balance to it, because when it goes well, you think, well, I'm the king of the world here. This is unbelievable. And so it inflates your ego. But then when it goes badly, it can deflate your ego so badly. So I think the truly like Zen state is actually to understand at all times you are, you know, neither the best nor worst person in the world. But what stand-up comedy does is it does this. So what you actually get is a kind of, you're like mean line. You're like, the average state of your mood is correct, but it means that it gives you, it's only a like average that you're taking of two extremes that you're constantly bouncing between when you do your job. So you definitely need, it takes a phenomenal amount of arrogance to get on stage in front of a room of people and say, everyone quiet, I have some opinions. And that is phenomenal. Also, it's phenomenal arrogance to think that you can be so funny that you can like hold the attention of a room. So but you need a bit of that.
This reminds me, because you talk, at some point you spoke about a 2019 gig.
Yeah.
That you had a you were doing a stand-up special, but you realized that the audience was all pro-Brexit.
Yeah, yeah.
And then what happened?
Chaos. Like,
before I say anything.
It was a charity gig at Christmas, and it was like a cricket charity, and so I was asked to do it because I know the organisers, and it was just quite a politically conservative room. Because cricket is a weird game, socially. Like, football in this country is kind of everybody, right? It's everybody is a national obsession. But cricket, it's very sort of, it changes depending on where you are in the country. And if you're in the Northwest, cricket is like a game that is played by a lot of different social classes. Whereas if you're in the Southeast, it broadly is largely the preserve of the middle, upper middle and upper classes, generally, right? I'm painting with a broad brush here.
Yeah.
But the problem is the gremlin that you throw into this machine is South Asians, because cricket is our football, right? So like, we're all obsessed with cricket.
Yeah.
And so I sometimes found myself in this situation where, because I love cricket, I was in a room full of people where you're like, these people really do not agree with me. And so I went on stage and I probably could have done a set that was less political, but I didn't want to. Now we go back to the arrogance again. And so I did it and it went real bad. But there's like an honesty to something going badly in a room, right? But then it became a whole other thing because it got a huge amount of coverage in the press. I think it was like the week before the general election. And so there was like a sort of volcanic, you know, reaction to that. And to tell the rest of that story would require me to do an 80-minute stand-up show. If people are interested in that 80-minute stand-up show, it is readily available online at nishkumar.co.uk. There is a sort of 80-minute story that kind of spins off the back of that one gig. Then takes in a kind of media circus, and it's a sort of interesting moment in time that show is really all about, that I then toured in 2022 and filmed in 2022. That was kind of a reflection on kind of the whole show takes place over basically 48 hours. And within that kind of 48 hours, I can hop in and out of different routines. But the general sort of meat of the show is basically like a sort of really weird 48 hours where you have a comedy gig that goes bad, which is every comedian has that, and then it becomes this kind of weird other proxy battle about politics and culture and Brexit and BBC balance and all this crap. But yes, nishkumar.co.uk. slash any music streaming service. The album is available on any music streaming service.
Oh man, I'm keeping it together. I'm trying to keep it together. But you know, there's something that I'm thinking of right now. You know, you mentioned earlier how your mom, and I'm sure your dad as well, faced what they faced in the 70s in this country. Now, I know you've spoken about how your parents wanted you to either become a doctor or a lawyer. You're the only one of color, I'm sure, that goes through this. It's a very rare phenomenon.
I might be the first South Asian where their parents wanted them to be adopted.
The first one.
I'm a pioneer.
Yeah, exactly. Listen, we're taking the layers down now, taking the walls down. But is there another element to this? Because obviously with immigrant parents wanting their, you know, their children to be doctors, lawyers, engineers, whatever, it's mostly about a cushy life, right?
Yeah.
Just being comfortable. But was there an element of, because of the racism that they faced in the 70s, that they actually wanted you to be in that profession?
Yeah, definitely. When we were growing up, we all sort of just, when our parents say you've got to be a doctor or a lawyer, we're just like, you don't understand us. You don't understand our need for self-expression. And it's kind of an interesting thing, because it's a thing that unites, like, it's a thing that sort of unites, like, all the ethnic minorities in this country and working class people of all ethnicities, which is the kind of upwardly mobile parent who is sort of saying, look, I've worked really hard and I would like you to have a better life than I had. And that is a really common experience, I think, for a lot of people. And the reaction of the younger generation is a tendency towards, well, I must have absolute freedom and I must have my right to self-expression. And that, you know, Billy Elliot's dad doesn't want him to go into the ballet because he doesn't understand Billy Elliot's need to express himself. You know, it is that kind of mindset. But in reality, a lot of the reason that immigrant parents are like pushing their kids to be doctors and lawyers is like, try and make yourself part of the infrastructure of this state. Try and make yourself essential to the state and the country, so that when it comes time, when it's kicking out time, like, I don't think our parents or my generation's parents, I think there's a part of them that always thought it'll be kicking out time at some point. I really believe that. I think there was always an idea that at some point we'll have to go back where we came from, essentially. And
wow, that's deep.
I definitely think that, man. Maybe it's just, you know, I don't know what, I think it's probably just like a paranoia. Maybe it's not even a paranoia. Maybe it's like, maybe they always had a transactional relationship with the countries they were immigrating to. Maybe there's also a part of it that was like, look, we didn't come here for the long haul. We came here to make a bit of money and then go back home, right? But it's a complicated idea. Luckily, there's no books, films, or plays about that experience.
Nothing on nishkumar.co.uk? Nothing
Luckily,
on the website?
There's no one has ever explored that in culture. But like, yeah, it is, look, there's a reason that it's, you know, there's a reason people keep writing plays, books and films about the same fucking things, yeah, because it's interesting and compelling. And yeah, there is something interesting about, I don't know whether it was because they believed it was a transactional relationship. And that transactional relationship may be cut both ways. But there was a part of them that I think for their kids, they were like, well, look, if you're going to stay here, you better have jobs that these people are always going to need. Like, you better be a doctor, you better be a lawyer. You know, you'd better make yourself part of the sort of furniture here so they can't kick you out. I think that's all they were trying to do. They were just sort of trying to protect us. And I don't think either of my parents were particularly surprised by I was surprised by the hostility that I came across. I don't think either of them were surprised. They were like, yeah, we knew that this was going to happen.
You received death threats.
Yeah. I think there's a part of them that was like, yeah, we've been preparing you for this your whole life. Like, we've been preparing you. You know, when the Robinson rally happens, a lot of us talk to our parents. Our parents are like, this is why we would, you know, what we've been preparing you for. This kind of anger is what we've tried to, you know, maybe in vain, but we were trying at least to prepare you for. Not, you can't protect your children from everything, but you can definitely try and prepare them. And I definitely think my parents were like, from a young age, were like, you know, don't cause any problems,
keep your head down.
Because if your head's above the parapet, it might get kicked off. Like, that's what that is. So there was like, that was part of their mindset, I think, in some ways. And maybe younger people are now a bit more wise to it, but I was definitely kind of naive. Like, I definitely went into a lot of those conversations being like, I'm British. Come on, bend it like Beckham. I saw that movie. I'm here. We're, goodness gracious me, we're part of the furniture. But then
now you realize, like, yeah, why would you think that that kind of anger would be expunged from society so quickly? Like, why did we think that in Britain and America, the like old, like hundreds of years of racism could just be snapped, like Thanos snapped out of existence? Mm. Like, why would you think that? Of course it was going to be painful, and of course there were going to be moments where things backslide. And I look at the Robinson Rally as a massive moment of social and political and racial backsliding in this country.
So how do you navigate political comedy at this point?
I think...
Or comedy in this political climate, I should say.
It's a great question. And I think you have to... I think you have to make a choice about... I think you just have to kind of be ready to take a punch. Now, that's not me saying to people, that's not me excusing any physical acts of violence that are meted out on people. That's not what I mean. I mean a metaphorical punch. You have to be, no one should accept any kind of physical violence, but you have to be prepared for, you have to be ready for the heat that you're going to take. And also, that's not me saying everyone should be doing it and get ready to take the heat. You just, if you're going to wade into those waters, you have to be ready for the sharks. That's my only feeling about it. And if you want to keep doing it, you're going to have to be ready for the hostility.
To bring it back full circle, we started with Mamdani. I'm going to end it on Mamdani. You had a great joke. It was about what? It was about climate immigration, I think.
Yeah.
Or immigration climate.
Yeah.
And you talked about Sharia weather.
Yeah.
So Mamdani got sworn in January.
Yeah.
Does Sharia weather take, like, does it take place back in 2026, do you think, in New York?
I'm trying to remember what the, I think he was trying to get conservatives to care more about the climate, and the way to do it was to call it climate immigration and say foreign weather is coming over here. They're bringing Sharia weather over here.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, it would be, listen, it would be a huge, huge prank for Mamdani at his swearing-in ceremony to use the word inshallah. It would be a huge, huge prank. It would be fantastic. But I don't know. He goes on a lot of gay pride parades for someone who's going to bring Sharia law to New York. I increasingly, you realise there's a lot of people that don't know what Sharia law is. And that's sometimes a problem. That is, the serious thing is, this is sort of sometimes the problem, is that people say stuff like, well, I'm not racist, I just don't think you should bring Sharia law in here. And you're like, what do you think Sharia law is? Like, what do you think it is? And you realise that people have made terms like Sharia law inseparable from the religion of Islam. That is racist. Yeah. Like, that is, that literally is racist. Like, we've got to sort of go back to basics with a lot of racism. You know, we've really got to go back to a lot of the basics of saying a Muslim is going to impose Sharia law is racist. I'm sorry that to say this to you, but
it's hard. It is hard.
You have to, like, when people say, like, you know, like when Robert Jenrick the other day says that multiculturalism has failed because he's in Handsworth in Birmingham and he doesn't see a white face, you go, I'm sorry, man, that is racist. Like, I'm sorry to tell you, like, that is, also, I don't think that's completely sound evidence gathering. I don't think that would hold up to any kind of scientific scrutiny, that you just opening the car door and looking out of your window is going to tell you everything about the demographics of that. You can imagine Robert Jenrick walking through the Diwali party in London being like, there's only South Asians in London. I've gathered the evidence. and I've only seen, I've literally only seen, it's Robert Jenrick walks into my family house, but he's like, there's only Indians in Croydon. I've looked around, there's only Indians. I think there's a part of us that just needs to go back to basics and go, here's a few things that are definitely racist. So at least if you're going to say them, don't introduce them by saying, listen, I don't have a racist bone in my body. It's like, no, but you've got a brain in your head that's clearly got some racist views. And it's like, it all comes back to, you know, you're being lied to. We're all being lied to. And we're being fed, we're being distracted from the real conversations that we should have. And like, I really think the thing that is most inspiring and exciting about Mamdani, I mean, listen, aside from the fact that, and we don't talk about this enough, his mother made one of my favorite movies of all time. Meera Nair, Zoran Mamdani's mum is Meera Nair, who's like one of the truly great filmmakers of the last 50 years. And she's made, you know, some extraordinary, extraordinary films. But Monsoon Wedding, which is a kind of sort of Altman-esque kind of mosey through a family wedding that happens in Delhi and takes in like questions about class in India and, you know, abuse within families, and it takes in really heavy and weighty conversations, and like, where is India at the turn of the millennium? But he's also really funny and really beautiful and really moving. That's one thing that's under discussed about Mamdani, okay? The guy's mum made one of the great movies of all time. But the thing that is most inspiring to me about him politically is that, A, not all Nepo babies are bad. Point one.
And there's some good that can come out of it.
Yeah, exactly. Rob Reiner, Zoran Mamdani. These are two concrete examples of where having parents in the media has yielded terrific children. And also this idea that politics doesn't have to be myopic in its worldview, that it can be focused. Because that's the thing that people keep saying about him, is he stayed on message, he was focused. He stayed on message, he was focused. But his message also embraced a lot of the complexity of progressive politics, which is, you know, we have to be willing to stand up for class-based interests and equality in other areas of society. And those two things are not mutually exclusive. In fact, they may actually, and this is a real shocker here, be totally compatible. And that the fight for working class interests is also the fight of the LGBTQ community, is also the fight for women's rights, is also the fight for rights for ethnic minorities. Equality is equality. Dakota Johnson? I'm trying to think of another good Nepo baby.
Killing me. Listen, I gotta put an end to this. This was a lot of fun. Nish Kumar, honestly, thank you so much. I mean, I was laughing the whole time. Ahmed behind the camera was laughing too. He's cracking me up.
Thanks very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Appreciate it. Thank you, Nish. Thank you for coming on.